Dickens was saying that what seems to be very clear from the early explanation is that there is definitely a purely mental process can have an effect which can be observable at the brain level. You know, for example, as a result of deliberately cultivating this aspiration. But then when understanding the differences between the individuals, again, the biological basis seems to make a difference. Some are more able to do this, some are less able to do this. Then we go back to the brain. So there's a kind of a mutual dependence there.
Well, although it is our view, Your Holiness, that the differences among people may be the result of their experience. So this slide simply shows that this is the area in the prefrontal cortex. This is what we call a sagittal view. If the brain is sliced down the middle this way and opened up, which we could do with MRI, non-invasively, it is this area where we find that those individuals with greater activation in this area are the individuals who are better able, when they have the aspiration to relieve suffering, they're better able to change their brain and reduce the activation in the amygdala. Okay, so the next question that we turn to is the question of whether these differences among people in their capacity to regulate emotion are associated with individual differences in measures of mood and anxiety symptoms and so forth. And what we find is that those individuals who have the greater activation in this area of the prefrontal cortex report lower levels of anxiety. They also report specifically having more positive experiences at work. That just came out of the data. We weren't necessarily expecting that, but they all are reporting that the more positive experiences at work, the more the activation, the better able they are to have the aspiration to relieve suffering and to do this task. And finally, there's another questionnaire which was given to the participants that was called reward sensitivity. And some of the items are these. When I'm doing well at something, I love to keep at it. When good things happen to me, it affects me strongly. And it turns out that people who were good at the task, who were very effective, scored highly on this measure as well. Now, we have also had the opportunity to study how this kind of mental training and mental transformation may differ in patients with depression, with severe depression, and to see if treatment of these patients to treat their depression using standard treatments, whether that affects their capacity to engage in this kind of mental transformation as measured by the brain. So the first question that we asked is whether patients with depression are as able as healthy individuals to enhance positive emotion. And so we presented them with positive pictures, and I'll give you an example. A picture like this. We asked people to increase their feelings of nurturance and well-being that they might experience when they see a picture like this. And we compared individuals who were healthy and we compared patients with depression. And the results are in this slide. And the blue line, the blue bar, are the normal individuals, and the maroon or red bar are the patients with depression. And this is an area of the left prefrontal cortex, the area that we previously found is very important for positive emotion. And when healthy individuals are asked to enhance their positive emotion, they show a big boost in the signal in this area of the brain. But the patients with depression who are here show very little change when they're asked to enhance their positive emotion. They seem to not be able to do this. Now, we also asked about their capacity to downregulate negative emotion, to use the same strategy that I described earlier, to have the aspiration, for example, that the baby would be free of suffering. Now, the blue again is the normal individuals, and the red are the patients with depression. And this is the area of the brain, the same area that I showed you earlier in the amygdala. And it turns out that healthy individuals, when they do this, again, and this is what I showed before, they're able to decrease the activation in the amygdala just by the mental transformation. The patients with depression show absolutely no difference. In fact, they slightly go up when they're asked to engage in the mental transformation. Now, what happens after we treat the patients? And so we treated the patients for 8 weeks. And in this case, we used a standard medicine that is used in the West to treat patients with depression. Standard medicine. And what we found is shown here. We found that the medicine enhances the depressed patient's ability to decrease the negative emotion, but it has absolutely no effect on their capacity to enhance the positive.
Yeah.
This is very curious.
Well, there are a number of other findings in the scientific literature, and it shows that the primary impact of the medicines that we use is to decrease certain afflictive emotions, but not necessarily to enhance the positive emotions. And this is where other methods and other strategies, such as meditation, in combination with medicine, may be helpful.
저는 is wondering. I mean, this is a very curious phenomenon. He's wondering whether the more negative emotions as have a sort of a closer bond to the biological basis as opposed to the positive emotions. And why is this the case?
I wouldn't use that explanation. I would simply say that the medications that are currently commonly used may affect brain systems that are more specifically concerned with the negative emotions than with the positive emotions.
If I could ask one very quick question, have any medications or substance ever been devised that have been demonstrated to enhance what the Buddhists would call positive emotions? Take this and you'll be more friendly, compassionate, patient.
Not that I'm aware of.
The possibility of this. Not just on Chamber. Menjiza, and it's not Ninja Chamber Kia songs, and they want the Rewa Chamber.
Ningo Ninja Chamber.
Was it the Yoro? Alan was saying that, His Holiness was saying that the science at the moment, up until now, the pharmaceutical companies and the science have not really, their main interest really has been pathology and looking at, elevation of specific illnesses. So naturally, the medications that will be available would target those areas. And then Alan was saying that he raised the possibility that in principle, can one imagine, creation of, pharmaceutical products like drugs that could enhance the more, what the Buddhists would call, positive emotions. And then Alan said, if that's possible, then probably, he thinks it's not possible.
That you can take a pill that will give you great compassion.
Yeah, I mean, I am skeptical myself, although in principle I think one would have to say that it's possible. One of the things, though, that is important about the scientific literature on the effects of medication treatment of depression is this. When the patients stop taking the medication, the likelihood of relapse is greater. There are actually data, good scientific data now in the literature to indicate there are few studies that have used mindfulness-based meditation as a supplement to traditional treatment.
Yeah.
Not as a substitute, but as addition. Mm. And in those patients, relapse is better. They're less likely to relapse. And so that's a very important issue with medication treatment. So I'd like to give a few other examples of both helpful and destructive plasticity in emotion. And talk just very briefly about effects of therapy a little bit more, both pharmacological medication as well as psychological. And also just remind us that there are positive experiences and positive environments, as Rusty told us, that can promote certain kinds of plasticity. And I'll give one example. One example in a domain that Rusty has studied as well, of exercise. And finally, I'll talk about some of the destructive effects with an example from the area of child abuse. So this is an article that appeared about a year ago in Science magazine, very high-profile magazine. Rusty briefly mentioned it. And what this article shows is that the medications that are commonly used to treat depression may work as a function of promoting neurogenesis in the hippocampus, the area that Rusty has told us about. This study showed that if you block neurogenesis from occurring and still give the medication, the antidepressant medication, it no longer produces its beneficial effects. So it's a very novel study in just raising the possibility that there are interesting mechanisms of plasticity like neurogenesis that may be important for certain kinds of treatments. Now, this is from a very recent article that also came out just a few weeks ago that simply shows that cognitive therapy, which is one of the only evidence-based psychological therapies that's been very well studied in the West. And cognitive therapy involves mental transformations of a sort. And what this study simply shows, and I won't go into the details of the finding, but that when the therapy works, there are changes that occur in the brain. So even though it's a purely psychological therapy, it's affecting the brain. But the way it's affecting the brain is different than the way medication affects the brain. And this is another study that very recently appeared on the effects of exercise. I thought it would be interesting to show, because Rusty's own work has shown the beneficial effects of exercise. And what this study did is to contrast people who were fit, cardiovascular, in a cardiovascular sense, and it compared them to individuals who are not very fit. And it studied a circuit in the brain that's very important for what we call working memory. And working memory is a cognitive capacity that is important in keeping information in our mind when it is not physically present in our environment. So, for example, if someone gave us a telephone number to remember and we keep the telephone number in our mind consciously, that requires working memory. And what this study simply shows is that the circuit in the brain, including areas of the prefrontal cortex and areas in the back of the brain, are more active during a working memory task in individuals who are more fit compared to those individuals who are less fit. And it also was correlated with differences in their actual capacity to remember. So it suggests that exercise is one of those skills or one of those activities which can promote beneficial changes in the brain. Now, finally, I'd like to end this section with a discussion of the consequences of child abuse on certain forms of affective plasticity. And this is an unusual experiment, and if you just look at these last few rows, what is done here is taking a facial expression of anger and a facial expression of fear in this case, or sadness in this case, and morphing the expressions. So the expressions then go from extreme levels of anger to a mixture of anger and sadness, and then on the other end to an extreme level of sadness. Now, in this study, children who are physically abused were compared to typically developing children. And in their interpretation of these faces, and if you look on this end here, this is where there's just a little bit of anger in the face and a lot of fear or a lot of sadness. These children who've been exposed to physical abuse overinterpret the face as reflecting anger. So this is an example of the negative effects of plasticity, and we will talk in a little bit about ways to promote more positive effects of plasticity. And so the last part of my talk will be on whether mental training can make a difference. And here, as I mentioned in the discussion the other day, there are so few studies published in the scientific literature on the effects of purely mental training on either on behavior or the brain, just almost nothing. There have been some studies with certain kinds of therapy that involve imagery. There has been studies. There have been studies of mental imagery per se, but studies of this of the sort that Steve Coslin.
What's the difference between the first and two? The first one is the study of the effects.
First one is the using imagery in the context of therapy. And the second one is just the pure basic research on mental imagery, like Steve Coslin does. Imagining green frogs and red apples and maps. So with the exception of this work, there is no rigorous study of the impact of mental practice on the brain. And that's an issue that that I'd like to pursue some during the discussion. And so at this point, I'd like to turn my attention specifically to our research on meditation. And I think now would be a good point for a tea break. And then when we come back, I will move to this area. So, Your Holiness, I'd like to now move to the effects of meditation on the brain, and this will be an opportunity for me to provide you with an update on the progress that we've made, which has been considerable, we're very pleased with our results, and we'll describe them to you. So the question is, what is the impact of training the mind on brain signals that are associated with emotion? That's really at the heart of some of our studies of meditation. And we have we have had the honor and the pleasure of working with extraordinary people in our lab as in part a function of the encouragement that you've provided to us, Your Holiness, and also to Mathieu's efforts to recruit individuals. And what I'm about to describe are the findings that we have now from a set of data where we tested 8 adepts and compared them to individuals who have not been trained in meditation before, but all of whom are interested. And with the help of Mathieu, they were provided with instructions to learn how to meditate, and they practiced meditation for a short period of time, a few weeks, and we compared them to the adepts in this series of studies. And I want to first begin by giving you some extremely good news. Some people here already know this. The scientific manuscript based upon the first set of findings from the eight monks has just been accepted for publication in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It's one of the most prestigious scientific journals in the world. And I think it's safe to say that there's been no study of this kind ever published in this kind of journal, in this journal before. And I'd like to present you with a copy. This is in manuscript form of the manuscript. And I'd like you to notice that Mathieu is returning to his roots, as I said, and he is actually a co-author of the article. It gives me great delight in the institutional affiliations which we're required to provide to have the Shenzhen Monastery as one of the institutions that has supported this research. So this really represents the culmination of a collaboration that began with your direct encouragement. And to get to this stage so quickly, I think, has really been very inspiring. And this really is honestly the first small step. And we have increased aspiration to move on from here. So what I'm going to be describing this morning are findings that are in this manuscript, as well as some additional findings that will be written up in the very near future. So this is another one of our adepts. One of the things that's been so important about this is that it has been a genuine collaboration. It has not been doing research in any way similar to the kind of research that I've done before. We have involved the practitioners as experimenters to help us think about the design of the experiments, the tasks that we're using, we have sat around our lab in this way on many occasions with Mathieu as well as with other adepts who've participated, and that has made this a personally extremely enriching experience, and I think it also has affected the quality of the science in very positive ways. This is just a few other pictures of... And this is Mathieu after he was coming out of the MRI scanner, having been in there for about 3 hours. Most people don't look like this when they come out of the MRI scanner after 3 hours. They look, you know, tired, but very unusual. So the other thing that has been remarkable is that here, the monks are actually, we trained them to be experimenters in the lab. Since they're able to communicate much better than we can with the Tibetan monks that we've had. And so it has been a remarkable collaboration in so many ways. Now, one of the ways that we began this work is doing something extremely simple. And what we did is we had the monks generate a meditation state for a short period of time, and it was followed by a baseline or neutral state. And we just simply had them repeat this on several different occasions to see if we can detect signals in the brain that were associated with these transitions from a neutral state to a meditation state. From the perspective of experimental design, this is a very simple but powerful way of testing whether there really are changes in the brain that are occurring that are specific to meditation, because we can have the monks switch it on and off. Now, one of the first things that we did is to look at attention, and as I mentioned in the discussion, William James noted in 1890 that the faculty of bringing back a wandering attention over and over again would be the education par excellence. Now, James said in his chapter a little later on that most individuals are unable to focus their attention on any single object for more than 3 to 4 seconds. When we read that quote to many of our monks, they just start laughing, just like Matthew is laughing now. But in the West, this is accepted as something that represents a fixed capacity of the human mind. So one of the first things that we did is to look at shamatha meditation and the training of attention using a very, very simple task that really is something that is common to this kind of practice. And so what we did is we simply had the practitioners focus their attention on the black square. Just fix their attention on the black square. And we were measuring changes in the brain. And these are the findings from that experiment. And we again had 8 practitioners and 10 naive control subjects. And what we saw is activation in a network of brain regions that previously have been linked to attention, which is not surprising. So areas in the prefrontal cortex here and areas in what we call the parietal cortex, both of which are known to be involved in an attention network. If you look at the difference between the practitioners and the control subjects, in every region of the brain where activation was present, every single region, the blue bars here are the practitioners and the purple, maroon, are the control subjects. And in every region of the brain, the signal was stronger in the monks compared to the control subjects.
Have they been taught meditation at this point?
Yes, they have been taught meditation. Now, one of the most interesting characteristics of the difference that we observed is illustrated in this slide. So on the left are the monks or the adepts, and on the right are the control subjects or the novices. And what I will show you is the actual signal in one part of the brain, although this is present in other parts of the brain as well, during the resting period, during neutral, and then the transition to shamatha meditation. So in the adepts, the signal remains elevated for the entire duration of time. And if we look at the control subjects, the signal elevates, but then it returns back to baseline. And so this may be a neural representation of the capacity to maintain focus attention and not be distracted and keep the signal elevated for the entire duration of time.
What is that duration of time?
The duration of time here is about 120 seconds, 2 minutes.
So within which there are several intervals of neutral?
No, during that period is all meditation. During that 2 minute period, all meditation. And so what the control subjects show is an initial elevation, but then the signal comes back down. So the next thing that we studied, and it actually is the focus of this manuscript, is the voluntary cultivation of compassion, which is something that we've been extremely interested in and very inspired to study. The fact that there are practices in your tradition that have specifically been designed to cultivate compassion makes it very well suited for scientific study. So this is a quote from Matthieu, and he may wish to elaborate, but I will just read it because this is a description in his words of what the practitioners were trying to do. And he says, here what we have tried to do for the sake of the experiment is to generate a state in which love and compassion permeate the whole mind with no other consideration, reasoning, or discursive thoughts. This is sometimes called pure compassion or non-referential compassion. in the sense that it does not focus on particular objects to arouse love or compassion, or all-pervading compassion. Now, one of the things that is of great interest to me as a student of emotion, and you may have seen this short video clip, Your Holiness, but many people in the room have not seen it, and I thought I would just show it, because one of the questions that I want to raise this afternoon with you is that if we are going to put compassion on the scientific map, we need to figure out ways to measure it. To do science, we need to have a measure. Margaret Kemeny, who's in the audience here, has been very interested in the Cultivating Emotional Balance Project to devise novel measures. So she has been interested in devising novel measures of compassion. And we don't want to do what psychologists typically do, which I think is the lazy way of doing things, which is to have a questionnaire where we say, how much compassion do you display on a 1 to 5 point scale, and have a person just put a tick mark? We don't think that will be very useful. So one of the ways that we may glean something about compassion is to actually look at a person's face. And so this is a video clip of Mathieu in our experiment, where he is first in a neutral state, and then that'll go for about 45 seconds, and then you'll see some movement of the body, and then there'll be a transition where the meditation practice begins. So this is the neutral state, we will give Mathieu instructions in just several seconds to begin generating a state of compassion. And it'll be very noticeable. If we had the audio, you would actually hear, but it's not necessary because you'll see the body change. So this is still neutral. Now, one of the things that is quite interesting to a student of emotion is there is a very subtle smile which is present. And Paul Ekman, in his work, once wrote that a facial expression can't exist for more than about 3 to 4 seconds. This is present and stays present, and it keeps going on and on and on. One of the things that I would like to explore is the demeanor of a person who is exhibiting compassion, and whether that can be a useful tool to scientists who wish to study this. But we'll talk about that later.
Jinesh was asking about the non-referential compassion as compared to compassion on particular object like suffering. So I mentioned that for the control, we ask them to first arise the feeling of compassion and loving kindness by focusing on specific object. But then for the sake of not mixing with memory, mental imagery, and so forth, we ask them to try to generate the pure feeling of loving kindness and benevolence and compassion so that it's more clean than having mixed with memories, yes, images, and so forth.
From an experimental perspective, it was appealing to start with non-referential compassion for just the reasons that Mathieu described, because there'd be other confounding factors. Now, this will take a bit of explanation. These are actually the raw signals of brain electrical activity that we record from the scalp surface from one practitioner. In each line represents a different place on the on the head, recording from different areas of the brain. This figure here represents a change. This is during the resting or baseline state, and then here is where meditation begins, right here. And this is the signal in a specific frequency of the brain activity called gamma. It's a high frequency, and it is associated with activation and with recruitment of neural resources. And it has been found to occur with mental effort and with various kinds of activation. And we'll say more about that in a moment. But at the point where the meditation starts, there is a gradual increase in this gamma signal that you can actually see in the raw, this is the raw record. Now, I mentioned at the outset one of our collaborators, Larry Greischer, who's the physicist, very skeptical. One of the problems in this work, which we actually spent a lot of time successfully, I believe, addressing, is that this signal is a signal which represents a change in the brain, but it also has some slight confounding of muscle activity. So we needed to convince ourselves that this was a real change in the brain and not an artifact of a change in muscle activity that might accompany the meditation. And our physicist initially felt that this was all artifact. And so it actually resulted in a lot of effort in our laboratory to do various kinds of control experiments. And one of the things that we did is Mathieu came into the lab and he actually specifically made muscle movements on his face to determine whether the explicit movements would produce the same kind of signal that we see during meditation. And it doesn't. Nothing like it. Totally different.
Gamma activity muscle activity
There's young daughter and check cash test meat. There's yachin, the soya chick, gambachin, gom, one of the yachin. Then tax 11 on the Kiabaka.